Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Jeff Shannon. It is Wednesday, so we are talking fall ball. And that means, Jeff, we are talking about your recent trip to Charlottesville as part of our hashtag True Fall Ball series. You and Zach Babbo made the lengthy jaunt from Baltimore to the Central Virginia region to check out Lars Stephanie's squad. It was a valuable glimpse, given that the Cavaliers do not play an outside opponent this fall. So we want to know what you saw. First things first, what was your initial impression of just kind of the climate and culture that Lars has built on campus?
So it's year two of Coach Stephanie's tenure at Virginia, and just talking with him a little bit and the players and getting a sense of the team. He's, one, able to kind of start this fall, hit the ground running, which is something that, you know, last year, of course, he wasn't able to do that. His whole, you know, element of introduction that he had to deal with last year. This year, he gets to start from day one, pretty much from the get-go in terms of doing what he wants to do. Some of that we got to see. Right now, they're doing, through this fall, they were doing practices on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, four-hour chunks. The first hour of that chunk was weightlifting, and talking with him a little bit, one of the things that he's added this year or helped kind of restructure this year was their weightlifting program. So last year, they were doing a lot of powerlifting and strength building. He saw a need to make adjustments there and add more fluid body motion and movement into their regimen. So you kind of saw a lot of quick high reps when we were there, a lot of different body movement and different weight training while we were there. So that was kind of fun to see. And Lars, the athlete that he is, did it along with all the players, and some really good photos and kind of good sense of his leadership and ability there. So that was a cool segment to see. And just one of those little wrinkles that a coach in year two can work with his team, especially the strength training and conditioning office at a place like Virginia, and add his touch to it. And just one of those little things that you get to see on a fall ball trip.
And so, obviously, the opportunity to watch a head coach work out is a special experience. But, you know, you've been around enough of these programs that you can probably get a sense of what level of athleticism and physicality the group is bringing to the table. How do you feel like the Cavaliers stacked up against some of the other groups that you've seen athletically?
I think their front 12 or 13 is, you know, some of the best in the country. Starts with their midfield, which features IL number one ranked midfielders for the past three seasons. Really, if I were to, you know, we're looking at the midfielder of the year award. If we did preseason lists like you do in college football for those awards, Ryan Conrad would be one of the top guys in terms of midfield. He brings everything to the table, shoots, athleticism. He was elected co-captain this year as a junior. And it is everything. And then complementing him, they're going to run, it looks like they're going to run Docs Aiken alongside him, which we saw last year. And then number one midfield freshman, Matt Moore, will be running alongside them on the other side. It seems to, that's kind of how it irons out. I was intrigued. I thought maybe they'd try to split that talent between two midfields, but that's kind of the look that they're going to go with early. Docs is, you know, just a really powerful shooter. Moore is a good shooter, good athlete. His real abilities are in feeding and finding opportunities to set up his midfielder and really the attack as well. I think that's where his strengths will be.
And so you mentioned the attack, and obviously they bring back a lot of talent and firepower, but there might be an opportunity for a newcomer in Ian Laviano to make his mark, huh?
Yeah, that was the kind of one of the freshman wrinkles that we saw was Laviano running alongside Mike Krause and Mike DeMario. Mike is kind of like the savvy veteran who's really, as Kerwin, offensive coordinator Sean Kerwin was saying, it has really kind of come into his own in his fourth year, and it knows everything that they kind of want to do on offense. And then, as Tiffany was saying, was Krause, you just kind of want him to do Krause things out there, be the superstar scorer initiator that he can be. And so Laviano's kind of has the job of working alongside those two and complementing them, using his ability to kind of get underneath, his speed, explosive, you know, first step to kind of complement those guys and complement a lot of offense that's expected to come from the midfield.
Taking over a role that was previously held by Zed Williams, not an easy task, but I'm sure that the roles will change and be a little bit different. One of the things about this staff and this Virginia squad is how are they going to emulate and how are they going to start to look like the Brown team in 2016 that took the lacrosse world by storm. It's the same coaching staff, and the idea, I think, in many people's minds is, well, you can just ratchet up the athletic caliber of the squad and take it from, you know, 60 to 100, so to speak. What was your sense of the style that this group's going to try to employ?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that we talked about a little bit was with those teams, so much of the strength was in the ends of the field, the goalie, you know, attack with Malloy and those guys down there. Those kind of like that pushing defense with the poles, and then you had some strength at the faceoff. Currently, this Virginia team is kind of built the exact opposite. The strength is in their depth in midfield and their ability to kind of initiate some offense on the attack. And that's where the strengths are. So it's going to be – and you got some players. I think Jared Connors as a pole is someone that could help with that fulfilled abilities that we remember Brown having. I think in goal – you're going to see a little bit more competition there. And Alex Rode, I got the sense that if the season started tomorrow, Rode would be their starting goalie, and he seems really good at making the explosive save. And at least when we saw him yesterday, his outlets look pretty good. And so in terms of, you know, when you're trying to get those balls upfield. But it's sort of the inverse construction of what we remember Brown being. And I think we'll see year 3, year 4, year 5, year 6 under Lars, that'll go back to what we're used to a little bit. But for right now, they got to play with the tools they have, and those tools are, you know, fantastic. It's just a little different look than I think we remember from Brown.
Yeah, it'll be really fascinating to see, and I think we'll, you know, kind of bring this in for a landing with this question. And I guess it's really simple. Like, how good do you expect this Virginia Cavalier team to be in 2018 based on what you saw in practice?
It's interesting. I think they can run with any team in the country, and we'll see some really fun games like we saw last year, 15, 14 wins and stuff. And I know it's a concern how they finish the season. That ACC schedule can be brutal at the end of the year going into that. And one of the things that Lars talked about is prepping his team at this time of the year and in January so that they're fresh and still ready to go at the end of the season. It's interesting. It's a theme that I've heard a lot from coaches. And for Lars in particular, and it's interesting that from an Ivy coach, you come from a place where there were so many restrictions about what you could do with players. And so when you did hit practice, you hit it hard and you hit the ground running. And I think Lars in his first year, he was saying that he didn't want to be tempted by that, but it was too much to not really get in there and take advantage of all your time. This year he's working on really being judicious with the schedule and giving those guys that opportunity to relax and find some freedom within it. So when it comes to the ACC schedule, they'll be fresh and ready to go. Looking at Duke, looking at North Carolina, looking at Notre Dame, it's tough to see. You know, can they beat those guys straight up? I want to see how the season plays out a little bit. It's not immediately like, oh, here we go, these guys can win this.
It's really fascinating because when you look at the 2017 season for Virginia in the rearview mirror, you know, you realize that they were 7-4 on April 1st. All four of those losses were by a goal. Three of the wins, Loyola, Cornell, which was an amazing comeback, and Richmond were all by a goal. Seven games that could have gone either way. You know, it was not a overwhelmingly successful season, but it could have been a disaster if some of those one goal wins had turned the other direction. I mean, you know, that season opening win against Loyola that was streamed on Twitter, a very memorable game. That absolutely could have gone the other way. By the same token, to your point about the way that the season ended, a 3-goal loss to Carolina on a Sunday night, another very memorable game, a win over Robert Morris, and then a 20-11 loss to Duke and a 17-11 loss to Penn that was a rematch from a 1-goal loss to Penn in February. it does suggest that maybe they did run out of gas a little bit. And I think for those who have high expectations and high hopes for Virginia heading into 2018, you really do have to take a second look at what they graduated. It's not just Zed Williams. They also said goodbye to Ryan Lukovic, AJ Fish, Joe French, Tanner Scales. I mean, a lot of guys, Will McNamara, a lot of guys who had played a lot of minutes for this program. I believe Jason Murphy, is the faceoff specialist, is also gone. So, you know, just a ton of question marks heading into the 2018 season. And when you consider the margin that was, you know, kind of represented by those results in Lars's first year, makes it very difficult to project what we're going to see heading into next season as well.
Yeah, I think just the biggest question I had coming out of it, and I asked him a little bit about it, is just, again, those first 13, 14 guys can run with anybody, but they really are going to have to spend some time building depth and pushing guys to add some weight to that roster in terms of filling out the second line, providing some depth on midfield at the poles. I think that's a little bit of concern, and you want to see that if you're a fan of Virginia kind of wrap itself up early next year, and so the all-similars are ready to go by the ACC season.
Jeff, thank you for the rundown of the Virginia Cavaliers. Everybody make sure to check out #TrueFallBall on Twitter, as well as the True Fallball section on InsideLacrosse.com. And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Kyle Devitt. Kyle, before we get to Brown and Bryant, which is where you were over the last 2 weeks, we're going to talk about RX Bar. They are our newest sponsor to the Inside Lacrosse podcast, and really what it comes down to is no BS. RX Bar's core ingredients do all the talking. It's simply like eating 3 egg whites, 2 dates, and 6 almonds. Turns out real food ingredients actually taste good, and now you can speak to that directly, having literally just tasted one.
I just had one in your office. I enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I enjoyed
me too.
My experience.
Whether you like sweet or savory, chocolate or fruit flavors, there's an RX Bar for you. Come in 11 different varieties. They're gluten-free, soy-free, and dairy-free. No added sugar. No artificial colors, flavors, preservatives, or fillers. They use the egg whites for protein. I don't like the taste of eggs, so it makes it difficult to like really protein up. But that's good, because these don't taste like egg at all. They use dates to bind, and I do like dates, so that actually helps. It kind of gives it that gumminess that you'd be familiar with a lot of protein bars, and then it uses the nuts for textures. It's breakfast on the go, snack at the office, or after a workout, which is obviously pivotal. And probably when you're listening to this Inside Lacrosse podcast, I imagine you're getting your swell on or your cardio in. And certainly the egg white protein stands out as a source of protein that is easy for your body to absorb. Kyle, for 25% off of their first order, our listeners can visit rxbar.com/lacrosse and enter the promo code lacrosse at checkout. That's rxbar.com/lacrosse and use the code lacrosse at checkout. Once again, we love when all these new partners come on board and show their support for the sport of lacrosse through being a part of this podcast, and can't say enough good things about RX Bar. Kyle, welcome to the Inside Lacrosse podcast studio. Isle North come south, cometh south. And we are going to discuss the Bulldogs and Bruno. Let's start with your trip to Bryant, because it happened first.
Yep.
And obviously, you know, you can make an argument that Coach Mike Pressler's program has been among, if not the most consistent program in all of college lacrosse. They're coming off of a first-round NCAA tournament loss to Maryland in the 2017 playoffs, losing to the eventual national champions. They graduated a lot in the sense that, you know, people were really familiar with a guy like Tucker James, who, you know, ever since his freshman year when he burst on the scene in that very NCAA tournament first-round game against Syracuse, people were known. But there's a lot of talent on this squad, too. What was your kind of main takeaway?
Well, you bring up Mr. James there, and he is the volunteer assistant.
So he's not really gone.
So he's not really gone. He's just not playing anymore. So his influence is still on the team. It's interesting because you got guys like Cam Ziegler, who's probably the leading returning scorer, as well as Tom Kennedy, midfielder, who actually, I didn't put this in the piece, so Kennedy is the leading wide receiver on the football team.
Oh, wow.
And didn't play for 2 years. They got a new coach. He went out his senior year, and he is like breaking records at Bryant.
Wow, that's awesome.
It's great. And you know, I think he's going to be one of the big leaders for them this coming season. I was not there for fall ball because he's playing football,
obviously.
But the practice that I went to, what struck me was at first it kind of looked like I was like, the offense were doing drills and the drills weren't going well. I'm going to be honest. Like, the drills weren't going well for the offense. The defense, as you would expect from Bryant, ranked 10th in the nation. I believe they were 13th or 14th the year before, known as a defensive team, great at switching into a zone, switching to man, shut off. That defense can do it all. Casey Broderson heading that unit up. Fellow Shire boy, shout to Mr. Broderson. Once all the drills were over and they progressed to a full scrimmage, you saw the full capability of that offense, and the sideline was screaming, go, 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 which if you watch Bryant play, you don't think go, 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 go. It's like go. Go.
Okay, I hear you, but that's also an ebb and flow type situation, because when Cody O'Donnell and some of the other defense to offense long poles were putting up big numbers, that was certainly not the case, right? You know, they were a team that was able to score in early offense. It just hasn't been there for the last couple of years.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, Pressler, you know, when I asked him about the offense, was like, we're not a team that plays fast. We're just trying to play faster, because to him, it comes down to volume. And with the rule changes that he anticipates, a rule change within a year.
Right.
Which I don't know if we've had a ton of coaches actually say that on record, but he said that directly to me. He's like, we're going to have a rule change. So he's getting ready for that. I think he's trying to build his team. I was actually got to sit in on some recruiting, tape. They were going over tape with guys. I'm not at liberty to say who they were, but it was a lot of offensive players. And they are looking to move that system forward and to score more goals in the NEC.
One of the things that you couldn't miss by reading your True Fall Ball piece was the entire aura facility situation seemed to really impress you as well. And obviously, chief among those is an indoor facility, which, given the location, is instrumental in being able to practice all year round, and particularly early in the spring.
Absolutely. And I believe it's called the baseball. It's got a baseball affiliation, the Conati baseball fieldhouse, but it does have lacrosse specific things in it, like the wall ball walls that I mentioned in the piece. The other thing is they built this gorgeous glass and metal weight room right when you pull up to the athletic complex, which is kind of separated from the rest of the campus by a giant parking lot that, accommodates students and athletes alike and staff. So you have this whole other side of the campus that is all athletic stuff. And I've done camps there. I've worked camps there. Blue Chip 225 was there for a while I was coaching. And I remember lifting in the basement at night just to go do something once we're done coaching.
To earn your RX bar.
That too. Yes. Got to earn it. So to see this beautiful, basically new, it's built within the last couple of years, weight complex with conference rooms, bathrooms, a locker room. I mean, it was unbelievable to see that growth just in the weight room, because that's the first place I saw it. And then I saw the field house and I was like, what are we doing here? Like, how are you getting all, I think I asked Preston, I was like, how are you getting all this money? He's like, the athletic department believes in the athletic department and the advancement of facilities. And, he was modest, but you got to say he's one of the guys that got them there.
Right. And not only that, but also it's a mutually beneficial relationship. And I think he has spoken at length over the course of his tenure at Bryant with respect to the loyalty he feels to the athletic department for the kind of situation they provided to him coming off of his tenure at Duke and the way that ended. One of the other elements of your fall ball check-in that can't be missed is it was pretty clear that there was also he made an impression on you. Mike Pressler is a guy in the sport that has an interesting reputation. I've always had really good interactions with him. And I think because of how central he's been to so many big aspects of the sport. Obviously, you know, the 2006 situation at Duke, even prior to that, so much about, you know, his tenure in Ohio as a D3 coach and rising to prominence and building that Duke program to a national championship game appearance in 2005. And then certainly leading the U.S. team to its last gold medal in the FIL World Championships in 2010. You know, Mike Pressler is an icon in the sport, and I just got the sense that you really enjoyed getting to know him a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, first impression, he scared the hell out of me.
He's an intense guy.
He's an intense dude, and I'm an intense dude, and he overwhelmed my intensity easily he does this thing where he'll put his hand on your shoulder and be like, "All right," and do a quick tap and like walk away. And you're always kind of like, "Do I follow him? Like, what do I do?" But as I kept talking to him throughout the day and we kept doing different things, by the way, thank you to the Bryant staff for the amount of access. I don't think anyone's done a direct report with them before. So when I sat down, I was privy to a lot of sensitive information. And Pressler at one point's like, is this normal? I'm like, no one has ever gotten me this far. Mm-hmm. And he was like, they were kind of scared for a second, but it's fine. Like, I'm here to help. You know, I'm not here to
blow up your spot.
Not here to be a gotcha guy. But you know, I'm just impressed by how the staff interacts. I don't think I put that through the piece as much. Very equal parts. Very, you know, Pressler wants feedback. He wants to get other perspectives to inform his own, which I think is something you'll see with a lot of coaches, modern coaches coming up, instead of the whole guy ringleader with a bullwhip mentality that I think some people think, you know, college lacrosse coaches are like, and there are some like that, but Mike Pressler is not one of them.
Well, we can't talk about Bryant without talking about the IL Northeast Prospect Day, which is set to take place in, it's in Smithtown, right? Isn't Bryant in Smithtown, Rhode Island? It's not actually in Providence proper.
Smithfield. Yeah. I actually make that mistake and someone corrects me on it because it's Smithtown.
There is a Smithtown on Long Island, so
yes,
that's easy.
That is, yeah, it's Smithfield.
Yeah. So that is set for November 11th. We highly encourage you to check that out. Head to insidelacrosse.com/events if you are interested in participating. And now we're going to head down the road to Providence proper, Brown University. You checked out the Bears as well. What were your impressions of Mike Daly's squad in year two under his tenure?
Just a totally different vibe. You know, you get the sense with Pressler that he's in charge, and there's no doubt about that. You get the sense with Daly that he's pushing them towards something that maybe they don't understand yet because they are very young, but their practice, and I'm writing about this. This will go up at some point, my fall ball all access with them. It was a war zone. Their practice was a war zone. All they did was play mini games. I didn't even understand the rules of half the mini games. Within 5 seconds of one starting, which is I believe it's called scrum, where it's a 2-on-1 and there's a cage, but it's a very small area. A dude got hit into the ball bucket and the balls sprayed everywhere and like smashed into me, and I'm just like 5 feet away and I'm like, I'm gonna stand back a little bit farther. You know, it's the intensity of that practice was unlike any Division I practice I have ever seen, and it's built on the idea of competition through all things. You know, there was, so he pairs the freshmen and the juniors against the sophomores and the seniors, and they keep score on a board like throughout the practice. And it's just those, there's no, you don't change teams. Everybody is just, you're a junior, you're a freshman, you're on the same team. You're a sophomore, you're a senior, you're on the same team. And they just battled like they were, you know, playing against demons. It was awesome. And every game was intense. No quarter was given. We're talking like 4-on-4, staggered sets for man up, quick 3-on-2s, full field, half field, face-off situations, and points were just being thrown at the guy at the scoreboard. That poor guy, I think it was an injured player, just kind of trying to keep track because it matters. Like, you got the sense that everything mattered in practice, which I'm not one of those people. I hate practice. I hated practice when I was a coach. I hated it when I was a player. Some people are just like, oh, well, you should enjoy practice. If that was my practice, I would have enjoyed it. Most of my practice was like, line drills and wall ball and like situational stuff, you know, and that's not fun. This looked like fun. There was always a winner.
How much of that is built off last season, everything that it entailed? Because I think that the 2017 season will be historically interesting for Brown. They were coming off of a Final Four appearance. You know, a couple balls go the other way, you can make a pretty strong argument they might have come home with a national championship. You know, there's so much intrigue around this group that returns Dylan Malloy, the reigning Tewarton winner, and they put up a 25 spot on Quinnipiac. And then, like, 2 or 3 weeks later, they're 1-3 with losses to Stony Brook, Rutgers, and Villanova. At that point, things shift into high gear. And, you know, they finished 10-6, one goal loss to Yale, who won the Ivy League championship and went on to the NCAA tournament, where they in turn lost by a goal to Syracuse. So it's not to say that, you know, a similar height was out of reach for this team, but that 1-3 start sticks with me in the sense that I think it felt like they figured it out, but it also felt like, you know, they were going to take a different approach when they set the tone this year in order to avoid a similar type of start.
And it's interesting you bring that up, because I actually talked to Daly about that. And one of the things he said was, you know, people think that the Tufts, the Brown system that was so successful with Brown before he got there, was just aped directly from Tufts, and it's all Tufts, and he created it, so it's a natural fit. It's not the case. The pace and space kind of nature of the offense and things like that and the controlling the flow of the game certainly is. But I actually asked him for a percentage, and he's like, it's 75% similar or 70% similar. And everything else is adjustments. And I think what he learned in those first four games about his team is that there need to be more adjustments here. We can't just do the system as it is. We have to play to the strengths of the team, which when you're the coach of a D3 powerhouse, you're not going to have, you already are the best. You know, you already have all of these options to pick from. I mean, Tufts had like 150 kids try out for the team every year, you know, whereas here it's a much more equal footing with everybody, and the system does its work, but you have to have the people that fit in that. And one of the things he talked about, what that was interesting, was the 1/6 aspect of everyone on offense. Everyone on offense is 1/6 of a whole. And how do the groups last year compare to this year? He said it doesn't matter. It's who do we have that can fill the 1/6 of their job? And everybody's job is kind of different. No one has the same job, especially in that system. So the way he put it was like, we were trying to adjust to guys like Dylan Malloy. And, you know, like, I believe Matt Graham was the only other guy who had a lot of experience on that team. We were kind of adjusting to them. And then we just took the reins off and let guys like Luke McCaleb go wild with the offense and draw more slides and take more attention and kind of take their 1/6. And now this year, he thinks he has a lot of guys that can be that 1/6. And judging by practice, like, if they play the way they practice, which I would assume they would, given how intense practice was, I don't know how he played less than that at all. They look way better than I thought they would look.
You mentioned no Dylan Malloy, no Larkin Kemp, no Alec Tullett. Who stood out?
I'm a huge Carson Song fan, which everyone, even Lars, knows that. I was a fan when he was a freshman. You know, I think he and Daly likes him too. He thinks he has the capability to be part of that 6-on-6 set. I thought Luke McCaleb was unbelievable. A guy who maybe people aren't really looking for is Steven Hudak, who basically only played last year. It is meaningful reps, and now he's a beast. Like, they would just scream. The team he was on would just scream, who? Like, every time he got the ball, he would score, and it was just like, Hudak! Like, screaming. Like, it's just a lot of screaming. It wasn't off-putting, because once I got used to it, I was just like, yeah. And I, you know, you can't really root for either team, but, you know, it was awesome to watch. It's just sometimes you get caught up in the energy of something, and a lot of times it's at a game. But when you're on the field with a team, and the team, they're not, you know, they're just doing their job, and you get caught up in the energy of that, that's pretty special. So I think I'm looking forward to watching this Brown team way more now than I was before the visit.
Well, Kyle, we really appreciate your visit here on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Make sure you check out all of Kyle's fall ball action on the True Fall Ball section of InsideLacrosse.com, as well as on Twitter, hashtag True Fall Ball. Kyle, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks a lot.
And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Isle Editor-in-Chief Matt Kinnear, who last week visited the Towson Tigers fresh off of the 2017 NCAA semifinal appearance and a summer in which Sean Nallen was unsuccessfully wooed by a number of other Division I programs. The coaching staff stays intact yet again. They're right off of 695 in North Baltimore. Matt, obviously for the Tigers, it's going to be a question of how do you replace as much offense as they graduated. And there are a lot of building blocks that are still in place that are going to maintain this Tiger identity that we've known to we've come to know. What was your main takeaway from the personnel that you saw at practice?
You know, Terry, it's you talk about replacing the offense. It's funny because I wrote a story in our fall ball issue of the magazine basically a year ago this month about how can the Tigers continue their success, you know, with them having to replace essentially their entire starting defense? And we saw what happened there. You know, they went to the Final Four. So each year they've kind of taken a step forward despite personnel losses. So that kind of makes you think, you know, and especially you mentioned the consistency of the coaching staff and how much that's been a key point for Towson. With that kind of recent history, it makes you think that these losses won't be that tough to weather. But man, it's a lot of production that they are losing this year. Ryan Drenner, Joe Sider, Mike Lynch, Tyler Conan, top four goal scorers. It's something like 160, top four point scorers. It's something like 160 points that they're losing right there.
Who stood out? Was there anybody that was like really impressed you in practice?
Timmy Monahan. He's going to be the guy for Towson this year. You know, it was kind of remarkable. You know, I had a little roster sheet that they put together for me, and I found myself looking at the roster sheet all the time because these are, you know, so many unfamiliar faces with this team. But Monahan was the best offensive player out there. He was kind of running the show. You know, their offense is designed in a way that you should be able to kind of play in all six spots on the field. And he was the guy who had kind of the most success from multiple different places on the field. You know, he kind of had the ball on his stick more than anyone, but, you know, he seemed most comfortable from the wing. But he had a, you know, rebound goal in the crease that was really nice in practice. You know, he took over at X for a little while as well. He kind of did everything. And, you know, he's kind of a example of the way that Towson has built. Also, you know, there's the recruiting aspect that they've, you know, probably been doing the best recruiting in the CAA and just the general program depth that they built through that. But they have this ability to land these transfers that make a great impact on their program. And Timmy Monahan is going to be the next guy in a line of players. You know, you have Alex Woodall, you had Spencer Parks. He's the next guy to kind of be that big transfer for Towson coming from Maryland.
Right, yeah. So a highly touted recruit coming out of Gonzaga, spent two seasons at Maryland, arrives on campus with, I believe, 2 years of eligibility left. And you know, I was impressed with Monahan. In, you know, he was one of the few offensive players against the U.S. national team that was actually able to make something happen. You mentioned Alex Woodall, and he really struggled in that scrimmage against Team USA. What was your sense of the faceoff unit? And it's going to be such a, you know, for any team that graduates a lot and has high expectations, the faceoff can be a panacea, whether you graduated a lot of defense and you just don't want to play a lot of defense, so you're constantly feeding your offense the ball, or if you graduated a lot of offense and, you know, you just try to prevent more pressure from being applied to your defense. The faceoff can be the linchpin there. So I have a feeling he's going to be pretty important. You know, candidly, I was actually surprised that, you know, he suited up in that matchup because there was some expectation that he wasn't going to participate this fall. What was your takeaway from the faceoff unit coming away from practice?
You know, to me, Woodall, his health was obviously the thing that I was looking for, and he didn't appear to slow down at all. You know, they were talking about how they actually, during that Final Four run, they used tape to kind of make an artificial hamstring for him, is how they described it, so it would kind of keep his leg springy, for lack of a better word. But he participated in every drill. You know, I wouldn't say he's ever been the quickest guy to begin with, but, you know, he was definitely out there participating in everything, taking contact. You know, they're not going to struggle there. But it kind of brings up the kind of overall question about their rope unit. You know, Zach Goodrich is just a monster. Great short stick defensive midfielder, but he's not going to have Jack Adams with him. You know, they used to call him the Twin Towers there at Towson. So that's kind of an area of concern for Towson. You know, obviously we're going to be talking so much about the losses on their offense. Their close defensive unit remains intact. But those short stick D middies, you know, that second short stick D middie is arguably the most important position on the field. Adam Cerebelli was a guy who really looked good in practice. He's a senior, just blazing speed. You know, he kind of just one man cleared, just blew by everyone multiple times during that practice. And Jimmy Wilkerson, he's a sophomore. Just guy's great position, has size. Kind of in a few scrums, he was just, you know, that guy who just kind of laid his body on the line and went in there and came out with the ball. So that's definitely a question mark, is this rope unit. But in terms of the guy at X, Alex Woodall, I think they are pretty content there.
And one of the things that is a hallmark of this Towson program now is they've become the model of consistency in this league is their approach to work. And I think that, you know, we've seen them up close and personal in the fall every year under Coach Sean Nadelin, you know, highlighted by following when they did Eric Kapitulik's program. And when I think about Towson and when I talk about him, I tend to try to keep in mind that this is a group that consistently gets better relative to their peers. It seems like the team that they are at the beginning of the season compared to the team that they are at the end is most consistently going to be considerably better. I attribute a lot of that to their approach to work, and particularly in the fall when, you know, you can work at a little bit more of a casual pace and focus a little bit more intensely on some of the details. What was your takeaway from this team's approach to work?
There have been practices I've been in at the past where they're just beating the hell out of each other at Towson. I didn't really get that vibe from this practice. I did get a lot more conditioning this time than some of the other ones that I've been to. But there's still definitely that approach to work. You know, one thing that, you know, they're not afraid to say to you, like, the guys who are not wearing the black helmets here, they didn't pass the run test. You know what I mean? So there's a little bit of aspect of, like, you know, if a guy's not doing the work, we're not going to make it a secret. We're going to kind of make it known that he has to kind of do better with that. When it comes to that, though, I think Goodrich is the guy to look to. You know, he's the model of everything that you want in a student athlete. And he was the guy when they were doing the sprints or at the end of the practice. You know, they kind of got into two groups, one on one side of the field, one on the other, and sprinted, you know, kind of around the field. And Goodrich was always the first guy. You know, he's your best player is the guy working the hardest. That permeates through your program. He's also one of those guys that if you ever notice when he does something good on the field, the bench just freaks out. So if he's kind of there, kind of setting the standard for everyone, you know, that's going to be no problem for them.
And then we'll leave on this note as it relates to the Tigers. Certainly Final Four trips are, you know, it makes your program, it takes your program to another level, and it's to be celebrated. And there's no disputing that. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. That being said, when you're a program like Towson in a conference like the CAA, your ability to be as consistent as they have been in the league is preeminent. It's the thing that you can control year to year. What is your sense of where CAA prominence fits into this team's understanding of itself, and what's your perspective, you know, being pretty familiar with a lot of the other teams in this league on you know, how the Tigers might position heading into 2018?
You know, I think that, you know, I don't necessarily want to peg them as the favorite in the CAA right now. I think that it's probably between them, Hofstra, and Fairfield. But, you know, they represent this kind of, you know, when you talk about the work ethic and the work that Towson does, they really take it personally that CAA, we're going to grind and we're going to be blue collar, you know, the public school kids, we're going to outwork everyone mentality. You know, they've really kind of aligned themselves with the mentality of their conference, if that makes any sense. So, I mean, I think it's surely, like, given the consistency that they've had, I think that they're the favorite in the CAA with Hofstra and Fairfield, like I mentioned. One thing I want to mention, though, that's kind of a not answering your question whatsoever, is I didn't talk about the Canadian influence on this offense this year. They're going to have three Canadians running in their top six of this offense. Just wanted to mention that. It's going to look a little bit different than we've seen Towson offenses in the past, given they've done the two-man stuff, but it's a little bit of, you know, just window dressing, I would say. This year, they have the personnel to actually kind of follow through with that. You know, you have Dylan Kinnear, no relation to me. He's a Western Canada guy. Brody McLean, who's a transfer from Stony Brook. Jean-Luc Chetner, who, you know, was going to be a very high NLL draft pick. He's from Richmond. He's taken a grad year at Towson. So look for you know, another wrinkle in their offense with the two-man game. And you know, the three Canadians who kind of play three different ways, which is interesting as well.
Yeah, I was impressed by McLean. He was, you know, he and Goodrich were the goal scorers against the U.S. national team. Nope, that's incorrect. Monahan and Goodrich were the goal scorers, but McLean had a nice look on the doorstep. He was playing on that low lefty position on man up, and you know, I thought he was a good presence and a nice addition to the squad. So, Matt, thanks for the check-in on Towson. We will look forward to reading and seeing the photos and videos on InsideLacrosse.com. And for all of your hashtag true fall ball, make sure to check out InsideLacrosse.com. We're winding down, but it's been an unbelievable fall ball run so far.
Thanks, Terry.
And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Dan Ayburn, who was on hand at practice last week at the University of Maryland, checking out the 2017 NCAA champions who were beginning to attack their title defense. Dan, what'd you think of College Park?
Well, one of the cool things we did do was check out the brand new Cole Fieldhouse, which was awesome. You know, growing up, I mean, when I went to Maryland, like, it was kind of like a student slash athletics facility, and what they have now is this brand spanking new indoor practice facility, and it was gorgeous, and it was so cool to watch the Maryland players practice on the turf with that thing like shining in the background. But breaking news, the John Tillman's Maryland Terrapins are going to be a good team.
I think that anybody that got an opportunity to watch them play against the U.S. national team a couple weeks ago had that expectation. It was interesting because prior to that scrimmage, I was talking to Coach Tillman. I mentioned that I thought maybe it was going to be an interesting challenge for him to moderate the expectations coming away from that, assuming that they were going to get spanked. You know, like, hey, guys, this is just a scrimmage. You're playing the best team in the world. If it doesn't go well, don't overreact. He's tested now with the exact opposite challenge, which is it went really well. You lost by a goal. You came back from a 4-0 deficit. Don't overreact. You got an opportunity to attend practice when they were dealing with those heightened expectations, maybe? I don't know what the right way to describe it is, but what was your sense of how they handled that one goal loss to the U.S. team?
Well, I went to practice and was open to the media, and we got to interview some players, and I really went down there with the intent of knowing what their takeaways were. And I think, you know, they kind of all voiced the same thing where, like, we didn't really do any scouting. We were kind of just told to go play the Maryland brand of lacrosse. And they didn't seem to be, like, too, like, overly confident. They're like, yeah, we had a great game, but, you know, like, we're really, you know, happy that we just got film from which we can analyze our performance, which is a very Maryland statement. But, you know, I think that there's certainly a little bit of swagger to the team when I went to see practice. I think that they know that they're a good team, and I think it's a lot of, you know, it's mostly in part because of that performance against Team USA.
What's the identity of this team going to be? I mean, you know, for a squad that graduated so much offensive talent, the three starting attackmen, you wouldn't presume that they were going to be offensive oriented. You mentioned swagger. Typically, that is actually associated with that ability to score goals. They put up 9 on a good U.S. team defense. But in your fall ball, your true lacrosse fall ball check-in, the standout to me was the physicality and the size and the ferocity of the defense, you know, particularly with Curtis Corley and Bryce Young kind of leading the way. What's your expectation for, now having seen them in the fall, the identity of this team?
Well, I think that, you know, after watching what they did last year in the postseason, Bryce Young and Curtis Corley, I thought, were just excellent. And I think them winning their matchups was crucial to Maryland just going on that overall title run. And then coming back, I think, is just huge. I know that, you know, people will look at them losing Tim Muller and say, oh, you know, Maryland's defense won't be as good. But I think anybody who watched them play last year knows that's not the case. I'm just really impressed, first of all, by the size. I think every, you know, guy on that defensive close unit, including Jack Welding, who seems to be the favorite for that third spot as of right now, is at least 6'0", at least 195 pounds. And, you know, just watching them play and talking with a lot of guys who've watched them practice, they're just so mean. Like, these guys go out and you see them play ground ball drills and they are just hacking dudes trying to get balls. I think that Dan Morris looks to have taken up a bigger leadership role than he did this time last year. That was one thing that, you know, Coach Tillman expressed to me, is that he looks so much better this time than he did last year, and that he seems to have gained so much more confidence and leadership ability. The most immediate concern for the defense is short stick, because the two returners that they do have, Thomas O'Connell and Adam DeMillo, I think that, you know, there doesn't seem to be a a bona fide second midfield as at this point. So those guys could see some responsibility there, which would prompt them to look a little bit on the younger side for SSDM. I think that's their biggest concern right now. But, you know, watching Neufeldt and Nick Brzezowski play LSM in practice, I think this could be one of the best LSM duos in the entire country.
No question about that. I mean, I think that, you know, if there's another one that can compete, it would be surprising. The depth at that spot is going to be really helpful and significant, particularly if they have to cover up some deficiencies from, you know, that fifth and sixth spot, that shorty group that, you know, if some of those guys end up playing offense, it gets attacked a little bit more. Jared Bernhardt, what can you say about him?
I was so impressed by his speed. Like, this guy explodes from X to above GLE. I remember one anecdote I'll share was that he just completely burned his defender and just shot this shot that was, he did not have to shoot it that hard, but he did. It must have been like 90 miles per hour on the run, turning and shooting. I was like, whoa, this kid's going to be a problem going into 2018. And then, like, he's flanked by two really young guys on that attack line who also got the start against Team USA, and Steven Schellenberger, a sophomore, and then Anthony DeMeo, redshirt freshman. Interesting enough, both of these guys, you know, their original plan was to not go to Maryland, but they ended up on the Maryland roster. Schellenberger was at Drexel, I believe, and then transferred, and then Anthony DeMeo was set to go play at Boston University and ended up on the Terps roster. So, you know, I think going into the season, I expected the attack to be Bernhardt, Bubba Fairman, and then after the news that Logan Wisnowskis was going to transfer to Maryland, that he might be the favorite, because everything we heard from Syracuse suggested that he was going to be a starter for them next year. So it's definitely interesting to see this little curveball thrown our way.
I asked about Bernhardt. Let's stay along the Bernhardt train, so to speak. The biggest move in the offseason as far as the Maryland staff was concerned is Kevin Connery moving on to become the head coach at the University of Michigan. Jared Bernhardt comes in from Princeton as the...
Jesse Bernhardt.
Sorry, that is absolutely right.
So many Bernhardts.
Too many to keep straight. Shout out to Jake Bernhardt. What was your takeaway of from Jesse's kind of initial, your first encounter with him as a member of the Maryland coaching staff?
I mean, it kind of seemed like there was a seamless transition from the Princeton to Maryland move. I think he really has kind of focused on, you know, getting those LSMs in shape and kind of, you know, preparing, I think, a lot of the younger guys to kind of step up in that role. That was one thing that was a major takeaway from this practice, was that I don't know if Maryland has had as many good poles and good athletes that could compete in that rope unit as long as I've kind of been covering the team. So I think that's kind of been his focus, and it kind of really didn't seem to be too much of a change overall from Kevin Connery. I think this is a defensive system that has kind of, you know, gone beyond the personnel on the coaching staff. It's almost just like institutionalized in a way.
It certainly is a part of the identity of the program, a part of the reputation for the team. And so, you know, it kind of brings it all the way back around full circle. You mentioned the conversion for Cole Fieldhouse. I highly recommend people check out the video that you made touring the facility on InsideLacrosse.com. And the last thing I want to ask is this idea of attacking the defense, the title defense. What can you say about that?
I just love the swagger of it. They're just like, we're not the defending champs. I think people look at that, them losing all three of their starting attackmen, including Tuwaitonga winner Matt Rambo, and they say that Maryland isn't going to be any good. And they've still got guys like Tim Rotans and Connor Kelly, who we haven't even mentioned yet, who are like, whoa, 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 like, we were crucial to that championship run as well. So I think that, you know, I think it's something that John Tillman termed attacking champions. They don't want to rest on their laurels. They want to go after teams, and they want to continue to be, you know, one of the best and premier programs in the country. And I think that is what the whole attacking champions thing is about.
Dan, thanks for your time. Everybody make sure to check out hashtag TrueFallBall on Twitter and the TrueFallBall section on InsideLacrosse.com.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.